morning, everyone. So glad to be back. I really do feel like I work here. Get right to it. I've greeted some old friends this morning, people who I've met for the first time. Everybody whose hand I've shaken this morning has immediately asked me, so what does that title mean? So let me start by telling you that. It refers to an old joke that I first heard, I read it in a joke book maybe 60 years ago. And when I read it, it concerned a woman named Amy Semple McPherson, who was a preacher who worked in California about 100 years ago. But when I was researching this paper, I asked Google about this joke, and I learned it was much older than Amy Semple McPherson. It went back into the 19th century, so Carl Goldmark could have heard this joke, but I doubt whether he did. I also found online some audio versions of the joke, which are much funnier than any version I could tell you. So here's the joke that I'm referring to in my title.
In Ireland, actually, you get what we call the fire and brimstone preachers. You get the fella in the pulpit, and he says,
I will tell you about the great judgment day.
Teeth will be provided. In other words, the lack of necessary gnashing equipment will not be a deterrent to the Lord. It can be made to order, and it will be. Can you see why thoughts of Goldmark led to thoughts of this silly old joke? Here's another hint. This comes from a movie that I liked when I was an adolescent, so that's, again, a pretty long time ago. The movie is called 1,000 Clowns. Never mind what the movie's about, this little clip can stand on its own. Oh, and before we have it, I want to thank in advance Ferenc, who's doing my little button pushing for me and prepared the examples. I always need that kind of help, so I'm very grateful. So can we have a second?
Well, say, I can do some routines too. Now I can imitate the voice of Alexander Hamilton.
Good.
I know Alexander Hamilton, and Murray does a terrific Thomas Jefferson. We got the voices just right.
Hello, Alex. How are you?
Say hello, Tom. You know, you should have been in Congress today.
Yeah. This is ridiculous.
You can't do an imitation of Alexander Hamilton. Nobody knows what he sounds like.
Well, it's the funny part.
You missed the funny part, Leo.
Okay. So, imitating the voice of Alexander Hamilton, imitating the voice of Thomas Jefferson, I can say I can do it. You can't prove me wrong. So once again, we are not deterred by what ought to be a crippling lack. The same goes, of course, for artistic representations, especially representations of the exotic, the thing that we're all here together to talk about for the next couple of days. Representing the exotic usually means representing that of which we have no knowledge. The overcoming of this handicap was Goldmark's particular specialty, and he knew it, and he boasted about it in his memoirs. He has a little passage about Die Königin von Saba, the first and most successful of his operas, which is set in what we now call the Middle East, right? To the musically educated European, Goldmark wrote, Oriental music as a whole sounds a lot. A matter of well-known differences in scales and characteristic turns of phrase in the minor. It was clear to me, though, that the musical style adapted to picture the grove of the Indian penitents in Shakuntala, and here he's referring to his overture, Shakuntala, of 1865. It's the piece that made him famous, and it is based on the story of an Indian play that is a Sanskrit play of many years ago. You couldn't use that idiom that I invented for Shakuntala to portray King Solomon's magnificent court. That's one thing. That the music appropriate to either of those scenes, whether it's ancient India in Shakuntala or ancient Judea for King Solomon, could not be appropriate to represent the Arabian Queen of Sheba or her Moorish slave, Astaroth, who sings, as you'll hear in the opera, a love call. And still, all had to have an oriental character, only each one must be different from the others. So he's distinguishing four oriental styles, or oriental idioms. There's the Indian, from Shakuntala, there's the Israelite, there's the Arabian, and there's the Moorish, of which the last three were to be employed and differentiated in the opera, the Queen of Sheba. But that wasn't all. There was another very special difficulty, he wrote, and it was one that several other composers had faced before him. He wrote, "I wanted the temple hymns, with their oriental coloring, nevertheless to express a sense of consecration and religious feeling to people familiar only with European music. The problem was to accomplish this without making use of the Protestant chorale or any of the Catholic hymns to the Virgin Marian Lied." In German. So now we have four contending Orientalist idioms within the opera. We have the Moorish, we have the Arabian, and we have two to represent the Hebrews, one for the court and one for the temple. And then he makes his boast. "I had never been in the Orient," he tells us, "but intuition helped me even over this land." Okay. But would it have helped if he had been in the Orient? And was it intuition that provided him with teeth, you know, to cite that old joke? Die Königin von Saba is most accurately described as a biblical opera, an opera with an ancient world setting. The sounds of that world are no longer available for observation, and so they're no longer available for imitation, whether in the Orient or anywhere else. Thus, to imitate the music of the ancient Hebrews or the ancient Moors is exactly like imitating the speech of Alexander Hamilton or Thomas Jefferson. Authenticity, or what we normally call authenticity, which is resemblance to an actual original, is not even an option. And it wouldn't even be desirable if it were an option, because how would we know if somebody was really imitating the voice of Alexander Hamilton, which we have never heard? All one can strive for is not authenticity, but verisimilitude. Not truth, but, now here I have to borrow a term from an American fake news comedian named Stephen Colbert. I don't know whether you listen to him in Hungary, but he has a word, truthiness, which is distinct from truth. Colbert coined the word truthiness to mock the deceptions practiced by American politicians, probably Hungarian politicians too, who tell voters what they believe the voters want to believe, and which therefore has in the voters' ears what they call a ring of truth, right? Which is usually false. The ring is false, but what the ring tells you, you think is true. To be satisfied with, or to be persuaded by, the ring of truth is to confuse truth with truthiness. Verisimilitude with authenticity. Obviously, we all do it all the time. Those of us who are professional scholars think we're trained, you know, not to do this. We're trained to know truth from truthiness, and maybe we do it when we're on our best behavior as scholars, but when we're off duty, we still do this, especially when we're listening to politicians, right? So what sort of ring of truth did Goldmark seek? Where did he look for it? What did his solutions to these self-imposed problems tell us about his and his audience's cultural assumptions? And those are the questions that I became interested in as I began looking into his work. Now, operas or oratorios with ancient world settings were much more prevalent 100 years before Goldmark than they were in Goldmark's time. Opera seria usually dramatized subjects from ancient Greek or Roman or Egyptian history when they were based on myths. And oratorios were almost always dramatizations of stories from the Old Testament, just like the Queen of Sheba, or the Apocrypha, but stylistic verisimilitude of the kind that Goldmark boasts about being able to invent was not a task that opera composers or oratorio composers set themselves in the 18th century or earlier. As we know, you know, there is a perfect example by Handel from the Oratorio Solomon. The entry of the Queen of Sheba, you probably know it, but here it is again, maybe you haven't. Did you think that sounded like ancient Arabian music? Do you think Handel's audience thought it sounded like ancient Arabian music? Obviously not. Do you think Handel thought it sounded like Arabian music? They didn't expect it to. They didn't want it to. It never would have occurred to Handel to try to evoke the sounds of ancient Arabia when he was portraying the Queen of Sheba. The kind of verisimilitude that composers did seek to convey in an opera seria were of feelings, right? And when it came to feelings, the human race was one, right? Human nature was one thing, and it was one thing from the beginning of time till now. This was the ideal, you know, of the Enlightenment, the idea that we celebrate sameness rather than difference. That assumption, of course, was also operative in the 19th century, in Goldmark's time. Goldmark had to be attentive to the truthful, or what people took for the truthful portrayal of emotions, as well as the truthful portrayal of the truthy portrayal of ethnicities. So the one of them, the latter, was an inflection of the former. There had to be a double code at all times. And Goldmark really, as I got more and more familiar with the Queen of Sheba, I saw how resourceful and inventive he was in finding solutions to these problems. And it goes way beyond the four basic categories that he enumerates in his memoirs. Obviously, his solutions didn't come from intuition. I don't think I have to convince you of that. But it came from well-mastered technique, which means familiarity with traditions of various kinds, and observing what other composers had done. And my observing his mind and work on this problem has very much enhanced my appreciation for his qualities as a musician. Specifically, they show Goldmark to be a composer who I think, if he were here to ask, might even agree with what I'm about to say, he valued versatility, or what hostile critics would have called eclecticism, but I would prefer to call it versatility because that has a good ring, not a bad ring. He valued versatility above originality, and he sought original answers to traditional questions. That meant that he viewed his profession as a practical task requiring the application of skill. Now, to me, these are all admirable qualities, but they do probably have something to do with the way in which his music was received and eventually discarded from the repertoire. Because, you know, it's quite an amazing thing. Even when I began to be a passionate music listener, and I'm going back now 50 to 60 years, there were several works of Goldmark's that were still part of the standard repertoire, and I learned them that way. One of them was the Rustic Wedding Symphony. Another was the Violin Concerto. These were pieces I didn't have to seek out. These were pieces that you might say came to me as I was a music listener. Not the Queen of Sheba, that I had to seek out. But there were at least those two pieces that everybody knew. Now I don't think there are any pieces by Goldmark that you have to seek out. I'm not sure what the case is in Hungary, but certainly in America, Goldmark is a musicologist, composer, not an audience, composer. And this is obviously, you can see this if you look at the reception of The Queen of Sheba in New York, when it was first performed by the Metropolitan Opera, when it was only 10 years old, and the Metropolitan Opera was only 2 years old. It was the season opener. It was a tremendous event in New York's cultural life. And it was hailed as a great masterpiece, and 15 years later, it was already out of the repertoire. And was occasionally revived, and whenever it was revived, critics had to answer the question, why are we having to revive this now? What's wrong with this opera? Maybe it had to do with the way in which it was concocted from various sources. Now, before we even get to the music, and here I don't want to spend a lot of time, because I know this will be the topic of some other papers, but the plot of the opera had to be invented. There is no story of Solomon and Sheba in the Bible. That is, there is a story. I can tell it to you in 2 seconds. It happens twice. It's in the Book of Kings, and it's also in the Book of Chronicles. Queen of Sheba hears that Solomon is very rich and very wise. She wants to test that out by seeing for herself. So she comes with an enormous retinue, bearing a lot of gifts to Solomon. As the Bible says, she asks him a lot of hard questions. And then she goes home, having said, you're even richer than they said, and you're even wiser than they said. I'm very impressed. And she goes home. That's it. There's nothing to, you know, if you're going to make an opera about that, lots of luck. But obviously, there are many legends about the Queen of Sheba and Solomon that the vacuum that the Bible has, you know, given rise to, including the history of Ethiopia. You know, the Ethiopian royal family was traced back to Solomon and Sheba. The Bible doesn't tell you about that part, but apparently, because we have an Ethiopian royal family, they must have done something. But that isn't what they don't do it in Goldmark's opera. Goldmark's opera has a completely invented love triangle between a hero named Asat, who was sent by King Solomon to meet the Queen of Sheba and bring her back. In other words, Tristan and Isolde. They have a mad fling, which means that he now has to renounce his betrothed, whose name is Shulamit, in other words, Tannhäuser, where Asad is Tannhäuser and Queen of Sheba is Venus, and Shulamit is Elizabeth. And King Solomon, one of the New York critics said, he's like the King of Brabant, which means he's wandered in from Lohengrin onto the plot of, you see, he's taking some recent Wagnerian operas and he made a plot out of it, in which he was able to use the characters from the Queen of Sheba. That's about as close as he gets to the Bible. Now, just as the Queen of Sheba's plot had to be concocted out of remembered operatic models, the musical signifiers that defined its various oriental strains were similarly adopted. They were all taken, as it were, off the rack, as we say. They all existed before Goldmark used them. He didn't invent any of these signifiers, and I will show you. And it didn't come from his intuition, therefore, but from his knowledge. And it was certainly not the result, as so many critics in his day used to say, of his own fremdartigkeit. You know, fremdartigkeit is what we would now call otherness in our modern academic English, right? So hostile critics always said that, you know, he was writing this way because, well, he had to write this way because he was from there. He was from the Bible, yeah? But no, it came from professional know-how, the versatility in which he took justifiable pride. David Brodbeck, who's in the audience today, will soon be standing where I'm standing, you pinpoint this distinction, I think, with great precision. In recent book called Defining Deutschtum, where you recommend that we conceive of Die Königin von Saba not as a Jewish national opera, the way a lot of critics like Hanslick thought of it, or even a Jewish Oriental one, but maybe that's what Hanslick thought, but as an out-and-out Orientalist opera, and I agree, except I'm a little uncomfortable with the out-and-out, because it sounds like, you know, that's a bad thing to be, Orientalist. Maybe it is a bad thing to be. But I don't think that we need to regard Goldmark as necessarily approving the imperialist project, you know, the exploitation of the backwoods people of the East, although it's very easy to show that as an affluent European of the late 19th century, he was a beneficiary of that colonialist exploitation. The point that's relevant to our discussion today is that as Goldmark persistently maintained in rebuttal to those who thought to other him, you know, he identified with European, and more particularly with German culture, and he saw his work as belonging, and here I'm quoting from something that David Brodbeck quotes, I'm getting this from his book, in its entire structure, he belongs in, his work belongs in its entire structure to German art. He's talking about the Queen of Sheba. Just as the composer living among Germans since his childhood, he means in Vienna, owes his entire artistic Bildung, you left that word untranslated, and for good reason, you know, his formation, his education, his maturity, whatever we want to call it, he owes his whole artistic temperament to German art. Beethoven and Bach were his teachers. I'm quoting Goldmark, so he said they were my teachers. The Fremde in the work, what is foreign in the work, is nothing other than the strong representation of a musical characteristic that is appropriate to the subject matter. So it's that representation consisting of Goldmark's Orientalist signifiers that I'm concerned with here. And there are many of them. And they don't sort quite as neatly as he implied into four categories, but they can still be shown to have been very carefully and resourcefully selected for the purpose that he had in writing the opera, even though they weren't made by him. They were very expertly selected and very inventively applied and adapted in the course of their application. I think Goldmark's most immediate precedent, and you recognize this in your book, was Anton Rubinstein. I'm used to pronouncing that name the Russian way, but I'm sure Rubinstein was used to being called Rubinstein, because his works were very popular in Germany. In fact, they were more popular in Germany than they ever were in Russia. And Goldmark knew him well enough, so there's a whole chapter in Goldmark's memoirs devoted to his friendship with Anton Rubinstein. So there's Rubinstein, who wrote a whole series of biblical operas, as you probably know, and two of them predate The Queen of Sheba, including the one from which I'll be playing some excerpts. And before the biblical operas, Rubinstein wrote an opera based on Thomas More's Arabian romance called Lalla Rukh. He wrote one, and Felician David also wrote an opera based on Lalla Rukh, and David got to the stage 1 year before Rubinstein, so he got to call his opera Lalla Rukh. And Rubinstein had to settle for the other member of that couple, whose name wasn't the title of the original. So no one knows that Faramorce is based on Lalla Rukh, unless you've seen the opera. But before any of these, there was another work by Felician David called Le Désert, his symphonic ode of 1844. And it was this repertoire that provided, I think, the quarry from which Goldmark was able to mine his Orientalist signifiers. We know that he knew all of the operas that I just mentioned, not only because all musicians of the late 19th century can be presumed to have known these works because they were very, very prominent repertory items, all of them. And, you know, Goldmark played the violin in an opera theater, so obviously he didn't even choose what he listened to. But he also wrote about them in an early stage of his career when he did some paid reviewing work for a newspaper. And also because he and Rubinstein were such good friends. And they even shared a librettist, and the librettist of the Königin von Saba, whose name was Salomon Hermann Mosenthal, was also the librettist for Rubinstein's most popular biblical opera called Die Makkabäer, the Maccabees, which was just before the Königin von Saba. That was his previous project when he worked with Goldmark. Now in the Makkabäer, and also in the earlier opera, The Tower of Babel, the Turm zu Babel, which was first performed in 1870 while Goldmark was at work on the Queen of Sheba, Rubinstein faced the problem that Goldmark described in his memoirs, namely the problem of differentiating among different Orientalist types, different strains, and in particular differentiating the Israelite from the other. The Israelite with which we implicitly identify, it's a Bible story, right? So that's us and all other Oriental peoples are them. And Europeans, of course, regard the music of the Israelites in any biblical story as some early layer of their own tradition. But there was still that problem that is, if you don't characterize the Israelites in some way, they'll sound Christian. This was a problem that a previous Russian composer, Alexander Sirov, faced with his first opera, which was a biblical opera, or an apocryphal opera. It's based on the book of Judith, and it's called Yudiv. Sirov had, the story of Judith is the Israelites against the Assyrians, right? Judith against Holofernes. Sirov had given all the Oriental colors to the Assyrians, which meant that for the Israelites, he was not using any special color, and all the critics complained that the Israelites sound like Christians. It was not a matter of actual imitation. He wasn't actually imitating Christian music. It was just that for the Israelites, Sirov was using his default style, his own style. And for Sirov, as for Rubinstein, and I would even say for Goldmark too, even though he was a little bit younger than Rubinstein or Sirov, the default style was a kind of old-fashioned German style from the 1840s or 50s that might remind you of Schumann and Mendelssohn. That was the default style. And so since he had left the Israelite music in that style, it sounded Christian. So I think the better word to use in talking about these effects and this kind of stylistic manipulation, rather than using the word signifier, even though I use that word in my title because it's the word we often use, instead of talking about signification, I think it's better to use a linguistic term, marker, and say some music is marked and some music is unmarked. The real reason why I like to use that term in preference to signifier is that when you don't mark, that itself can be a mark, as it turned out for Sirov. But Rubinstein tried to get around that. He had Sirov's previous attempt as a kind of negative example. So I'm going to play his three little excerpts, and alas, I'm going to have to play them on the piano, and I'm going to have to play them on Bartok's piano, which again, I have to ask the Lord to forgive me for playing such bad music on this instrument. But Rubinstein's music is, with him it's easy to say why we don't know the word. In fact, in the memoirs of Carl Goldmark, he records he had an argument with Rubinstein at one point. And Rubinstein boasted, "You know, Goldmark, in the time it takes you to write one piece, I could write 100. And when you listen to him, yes, indeed you could. In fact, 100,000. So this is how Rubinstein differentiates. You know, the big event in the story of the Tower of Babel is the differentiation of languages, right? So the differentiation of markers. It's an opera about marking. And the main differentiation is between the descendants of the three sons of Noah, whose names are Shem, Ham, and Japheth in the Bible, or in English, King James English, Sem, Ham, and Japheth. And so there are three big choruses after the differentiation when each of them sings about how we no longer can understand our brothers. And the sons of Sem, and the sons of Sem, of course, are the Semites. That's how we get that word. Their music goes like this. Sons of Sem, and the sons of Ham, the Hamites, they go like this. But American kids go like this in the camera, that means Indians, right? As in cowboys and Indians. Open fits in the bass. Semites, Phrygian scale over a drone fifth, that's Hamites. And for the Japhethites, or Japhethites, he used a different technique altogether. Let's see if you know this. Turkish music as you might observe in Turkey, but Turkish music as you might observe in an opera house in Russia where they're performing Glinka, you see? So it's all within the Russian opera tradition. Now there's a Russian legend that that's a real Turkish melody that Glinka used. I have not personally verified this, but you know, it doesn't matter. What matters is that when you hear yum da dee da da dee 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 dee, first think of Ruslan, and you think of Glinka, and then you think of the Turkish melody, so that's authentic Turkish. Okay, so this is the way in which Rubinstein solved the problem that Goldbach posited. And you can find the same devices in Die Königin von Saba, similarly differentiated and similarly distributed. And critics noticed them and reported them at the time of the first performance, just as we can do now. Now, there were always those who attributed the markers, just as we do now, or just as I'm suggesting that we should do, to what David Brodbeck calls an exoticist strategic choice on the composer's part, in other words, selecting with an eye towards being truthy, right, achieving an effect of verisimilitude. And there were always those who, in Goldmark's own words, tended insultingly to attribute his Orientalisms not to his shtick, as he puts it, but to his gemut. Or as the translator of his memoirs put it, they were attacking my temperament, or rather my essential being, rather than my composition. They were talking ad hominem rather than ad rem. The same critic, in fact, could at various times argue either way, and Hanslick was among the critics who did this. On the one hand, he could observe that to the modern composer, the ethnographically sharp differences among Indian, Persian, Egyptian, Hebraic must, in any case, nearly dissolve into a general idea, Oriental music, from which you make selections. By which he meant that they were all the same, and not that they were all the same, or not that they were interchangeable, but that their representation and their differentiation was arbitrary and imaginative, just the way I'm saying that Goldmark's was. Or, as David Brumley puts it, that the markers relate much more closely to one another than they do to any particular ethnic musical practice. So Hanslick was able to discern that much. But then, the same Hanslick, 2 years later, and this is what gets me, later he was stupider. And that's not the way it should be with any critic. Because he backslid into some really appalling essentialist observations about Goldmark. Reviewing the latest Goldmark opera called Merlin, which is not Orientalist, he remarked with approval that it's free of the Jewish Oriental melodies whose sickly moaning spoiled for us the undeniable beauties of Die Königin von Saba. And then he added this. The subject matter certainly justified the Jewish local color in the music of Die Königin, but it didn't make it any more pleasing. Will Die Königin von Saba, precisely because of this striking national character, be judged more original or more Goldmarkian than Merlin? That may be the case, and it wouldn't exactly be unfounded. The Oriental, with its passion and colorful display, but also with its unrest, intensity, and exalted solemnity, does not lie merely within the subject matter of Die Königin von Saba, but within our composer himself, who grew up under a doubly Oriental influence, the Jewish and the Hungarian. So take that, residents of Budapest. Goldmark, now you might say that Goldmark's very ability to produce Merlin after writing Die Königin von Saba would itself have been enough to rebut this silly observation of Hanslick's. But I don't think there were serious surmises on his part. I would attribute them probably more likely to the same squeamishness that Hanslick experienced alongside Goldmark. It was the squeamishness of a German-speaking Jewish immigrant from the outlying provinces, in Hanslick's case, Bohemia, to Vienna. Now that describes both Hanslick and Goldmark. So the same squeamishness that Hanslick was expressing here, I believe, was also Goldmark's squeamishness. In any case, it's, I think, a great pleasure to turn from this kind of silly reception of Goldmark's Orientalist opera to a wonderful comment by a Russian critic whose name is very un-Russian. His name is German Augustovich Laroche. Laroche is French. German is Hermann, August. So he was from a French, German-speaking family living in Russia. But he was Russian-born, and he wrote in Russian, and he was one of the great Russian critics of the 19th century. And when he reviewed the Tower of Babel, the opera from which I was playing those excerpts before, he wrote this. In what does Alexander Serov's masterly characterization of the extinct Assyrians in his opera Yudif consist, or Anton Rubinstein's of the ancient Semites in his sacred opera The Tower of Babel? Obviously in one thing only. The composers have successfully reproduced our subjective idea of the Assyrians and the Semites. This, at last, gets everything right. It places the emphasis not on the composer's input, but on the audience's perception. The audience is the final judge of all these things. Or rather, I should say, it puts the emphasis on the composer's strategic calculation, as David Brumley would say, of the audience's likely perception, which enables the critic to see that teeth were being provided. And Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson were being successfully, which is to say truthfully, represented or impersonated. So now it's time to take a closer look at that impersonation, that original deployment of stereotypes. Although I know that's an oxymoron, but I think I can redeem it, original use of stereotypes. I believe that Goldmark's treatment of his Orientalist markers is subtler and more canny than any of the examples that I've been discussing up till now. This applies even or especially to the most hackneyed of all Orientalist markers, namely the augmented seconds. And the amazing thing, if you study carefully the Koenig and Funzaba, is how rare they are in the opera. You have to look really hard to find them. Especially if you compare them with other operas, including one actually precisely contemporaneous opera, which I think people still know because it's still occasionally performed, Samson et Davila by Samson. Samson, Samson. Do you think he noticed that? Yeah, but he did. So you remember the Bacchanal from Samson et Davila? You probably do, but here it is anyway. That's enough, perhaps more than enough. Now you know, Die Königin von Saba has a bacchanal too. It's the end of the ballet music in Act 3. But it takes place at King Solomon's court, not among the Philistines, you know, as it does in Samson et Dalila. So as orgies go, it's pretty restrained. So here's the gold mark. Now, in order to prove that there are no augmented seconds in Goldmark's Bacchanal, I'd have to play the whole Bacchanal. That's the difficulty with negative proof, you know. If I say Samson has augmented seconds, I just play you one of them and that's enough. You'll have to take it on faith that it all sounds like that. Why are there no augmented seconds here? Again, it's probably Broadbent would confirm. It's a matter of Deutschtum. Wir Deutscher are very restrained and decorous compared to those Southern people, the French and the Russians. I don't know why they're Southern, but they are not German anyway. The other side of that restraint is the squeamishness that Goldmark surely felt on account of being Jewish. One American critic, Henry Krehbiel, assumed when he reviewed the opera in New York that Goldmark was speaking his native language in Die Königin von Saba. And we've already seen that Hanslick made this mistake too. Reacted with squeamishness to the Jewish coloring, and it was a squeamishness, I think, that Goldmark must have shared. But the essentializing process works the other way, too. You know that there were many who thought that Samson was Jewish. That during the Dreyfus period, the end of the 19th century in France, rumors went around that Samson was a member of the Kahn family, you know, the banking family, and that his name was really Kahn. And did you know that the Nazis banned Samson's music because they suspected he was Jewish? And the only evidence for Samson being Jewish is da 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 dee 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 dee. But it was enough to get him banned. So according to this kind of criticism, show me your blood and I'll tell you what kind of music you'll write, or show me your music and I'll tell you what kind of blood you have. And if your music and your blood don't match up, well, you're just plain inauthentic, and we don't listen to you. Obviously, Goldmark wanted none of this. So augmented seconds were, well, no augmented seconds in my bacchanal, he must have decided, you know. The music does have a share of markers, his bacchanal, but since I didn't play it for you, I don't want to go into them. But not that one. So owing to their scarcity, then, the augmented seconds in the Königin von Saba are especially telling when they do occur. So what do they tell us? So here's one of their rare appearances. It comes from Act 1, and it occurs near the end of the triumphal march, which heralds the arrival of the Queen of Sheba. It's exactly the equivalent number to the one by Handel, you know? But it takes 10 times as long, and it's just like Verdi's triumphal march in Aida, which I'm sure Goldmark knew and took as a model, because it has various sections that change according to what the contingent is parading by, you know, in the march. So It opens with these are King Solomon soldiers, and they come into this kind of music. That could have come out of the prophet, you know, by Meyerbeer, or it could be Crusaders. It could be anything with two legs. I can signify. Next, we get women and maidens accompanied by Solomon's female slaves, and they sound like this. Okay, so clearly, because they're Solomon's slaves, they are still us, not them, right? But things get a bit wilder when they appear, when the queen's retinue makes its appearance on stage. First, her slaves, white and black. So the fact that there are white and black makes them a bit fremdartish, you know? So here, let's listen to this. Her slaves. Right? It starts just like the Hamitic chorus in Rubinstein. And now finally, the last contingent to enter the stage, here we, as Sigmund Freud would say, this is where the body's buried, right? The female slaves appear, the dark-skinned female slaves. And with them, we get finally augmented seconds. It's sufficiently far away from Goldmark's own, both his own ethnicity and his own gender, that he could risk it, you see? So here we are. So that section gives way to a reprise of the previous one associated with male slaves, and then comes the entrance of the queen herself on her palanquin, together with Osterode, her slave, who is designated in the Grammatis Personae as Aenamorin, so you know that what color she has to be. So nota bene, augmented seconds make their appearance together with dark skin and feminine gender. And that association holds through the opera, especially, its most famously orientalizing moment, which we'll get to very soon. But before we get into that, there's one apparent slight contradiction to this generalization that I'd like to focus on. At the very beginning, the prelude to the opera, which is played with the curtain down, we get this after a couple of introductory, rather proclamatory kind of, you know, get your attention. We get the first theme of the overture that sounds like this. Signifying at this moment, we're not seeing anything when we hear this. So you could say it's a floating signifier at this point. It's not attached to a referent, and therefore not yet a signifier at all, except insofar as it might identify the whole opera as being oriental. But of course the title has already identified it as oriental, so that's probably what we think. It's the familiar question, you know, when does a leitmotif become a leitmotif? And the answer to that, of course, is when it's repeated. But actually, I don't think that really is the answer. The answer is when its repetitions first get noticed, it becomes a leitmotif. And it's up to the composer to make sure he notices. And of course, not everybody notices, and there are some who will always miss it, and there are some who get it the first time. And so what is a leitmotif is something the audience answers. Who's the audience? Anybody who hears it is the one who reacts to the leitmotif and turns it, therefore, into a leitmotif. So the first time we hear the opera, I doubt whether the association is prominent enough to get made. But by the time I'd studied the opera, I noticed that this music comes back at the beginning of the temple scene in Act Two, which was supposed to be the marriage of Assad and Shulamit. And the Hebrew priests sing that melody that we just heard to the words, Danke dem Herrn, denn ist freundlich, ewig wird seine Güte, his goodness endureth forever. So, ewig wird seine Güte is where this comes back. So, here, an augmented second, as well as a diminished fourth, is being associated with the Israelites. And it is, for that reason, I would say, the mildest, most tentative, least marked form an augmented second can take. In normal harmonic usage, it's between the sixth and seventh degrees of a minor scale, producing what's called the harmonic minor, right? That's the scale that good little Aryan boys and girls practice on the piano every day, right? So it's least tainted of any possible augmented second. So that's the one that can be applied with impunity, you might say, to the Israelites. And I think Goldmark felt he needed to do that because you remember what he wrote in his memoirs. He wanted the temple hymns to express a sense of consecration and religious feeling without making use of Protestant chorales or Catholic hymns of the Virgin. So a very, very slight degree of Oriental marking, just so you know that they're not Christian. But the augmented seconds that characterize the Moorish slaves and the Queen of Sheba's retinue are not that kind of augmented second. They take place between the third and fourth degree of the scale. Ya da da dee, ya da da dee, ya da da dee 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 dee. So that means they're part of I don't know what to call it. Sometimes it's called the Gypsy scale. Sometimes it's called the Hungarian minor. I wouldn't call it that here. Or some other kind of ersatz. It's not normal Western harmony, right? They are literally outlandish when you use the augmented second between scale that reads three and four. And they come in tandem with what one critic, Richard Specht, called the Goldmark Triola. The little triplet on the first beat. He said that shows its Goldmark, and he was thinking of Shakuntala. I don't know whether anybody still knows the Shakuntala, which begins, but now I'm not going to be able to remember. Anybody remember the tune? Da 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 and so on. So that's associated with Goldmark, but you notice that Rubinstein had it too. So it wasn't really Goldmark Triola, but he used them a lot, so that became him. And according to Specht, the Goldmark Triola marked Goldmark's alttestamentarisches trunkenes Gepräge, his Old Testament drunken character, even though the locus classicus was Shakuntala, which had nothing to do with the Old Testament, and she never gets drunk. So, the device means whatever the listener thinks it means. That's the part that most critics forget about. Even more outlandish is the so-called Lochruf, the weird melody that Osterote, the Moorish slave, gets to sing, or is given to sing in the second act of the Königin von Saba as a prelude to the big love scene between Assad and the Queen of Sheba. This is a truly bizarre moment. Astaroth tells the queen that she's noticed Assad lurking in the vicinity. So the queen gives her an order. Tifa stille ringsum her, niemand sieht uns, lock ihn her. There's deep silence all around, nobody sees us, lure him hither. Whereupon Astaroth sings an incantation that Richard Strauss certainly remembered when he wrote Zalame. Listen to this. The words go, as reeds attract herons, as doves coo in the moss, through the night's concealing veil, I lure him to thy lap. This is a record that was made not quite 100 years, it was made 90 years ago by Zelma Kurz, who was the great coloratura, reigning coloratura of the Vienna Opera, even under Gustav Mahler. And now listen to the Lockruth itself, it's a big unaccompanied solo. And we'll listen to the whole thing. This is the longest example I've played, because this is really, really sensational singing. In fact, I think she sings the best trill ever recorded during this Lockruth. Such as it is in English, The word Lochroof is usually translated as siren song, but you know, its more usual meaning in German is a mating call, from one animal to another, including the kind of mating call that hunters simulate with specially designed instruments called Lochmittel or Lochpfeife, to lure their quarry, which is exactly what the Queen of Sheba is doing here. She's using Astaroth as a Lochpfeife. So it's like a duck call, you know, to get the duck on stage. Or actually, if you know what Assad means in Arabic, and nowadays that name is in the news all the time, Assad, right, means lion. So to bring the lion on stage. But when he comes on stage, he has become a lamb, because that's the thing that Oriental sex does to you, if you're a man. We'll skip the next example, before we get to the next one. Just a word about the Lochroof itself. You noticed it was not in any one scale. You can't refer to any one particular scale, but what he seems to be doing is composing out the same progression that he has, and it reminded me of Salome. I don't know if Heinrich Schenker would approve of my calling this an Hauskomponierung, but I'll call it that anyway. It's alternating G minor and the diminished seventh chord, that has a G in it, a G and a B flat in it. And so alternate phrases are G minor and diminished seventh, with all the intervals of a diminished seventh chord being emphasized in the augmented second and the tritone, and so on. So the Lord Assad comes on stage, and he sings the most famous number in the entire opera. Goldmark took great pride in the fact that he thought of putting this there. It wasn't Mosenthal's idea, it was his idea. To have him sing a little romance, it's called Magashitina. And it's the one item from the opera that everybody knew and everybody sang. And it still occasionally even gets recorded now without the rest of the opera by tenors. But it's very important, as I say, to play old recordings. And I chose the oldest recording of this I could find. This was recorded by everybody in the early 20th century, from Leo Slezak, who used to specialize in this role, who was very famous as Assad, to Enrico Caruso, who made a recording of this, but a terrible one because he used his technique rather than the technique that you're about to hear. This is Desider Arany, the Hungarian tenor, who recorded the aria, or the romance actually, in 1903. And here is the end of it. Goldmark might have heard this. Falsetto, even Caruso has to sing that note, falsetto, to sing it piano. But up till the last phrase, he's trying his best to maintain his chest voice into his top register the way a tenore robusto would do, you know? Completely the opposite of what I'm sure that Goldmark was counting on here. He was counting on a sound similar to that of a musico, you know, an alto travesti. From earlier 19th century operas, if you think of Ratmir, Ruslan Lyudmila, same kind of Oriental lover, was sung in that crooning kind of a falsetto or kind of a eunuch voice to show the effect of the Oriental lure on him. Now my time is running out, so I'll just go to the last three examples. That, I think, shows how important timbre is to our appreciation of markers. It isn't just the notes that the composer writes, it's also the timbres. And it goes for instrumental timbres too, as you can easily imagine. The Queen of Sheba has lots of English horn, and it has lots of harp. And there's one scene where Shulamit is being accompanied by her girlfriends at the backup chorus. And they are playing harps and also tambourines and triangles. And the harp is being mimed on stage and played in the pit. But the tambourines and triangles are to be played by the choristers themselves. And so this is very unusual. Those parts are actually in the vocal score, so that the choristers have the music they have to play, if you want to call it music. Have a listen. This is the number that has the harps and the triangles. Even on this old record, this is Maria Németh, the Hungarian-born soprano, also from the Vienna Opera, made around 1915. Can you go? Actually, let's skip it because you. The part with the chorus comes a little later. I also. All right, we can skip it. Listen to it sometime, it's on YouTube. Most of my examples came from the amazing YouTube. And you can hear very clearly the onstage tambourines. So we'll go to the last pair of examples to show how important, or how subtle Goldmark's use of these markers could be. I want to play you a little bit from the overture, just so you'll hear. There's a certain motif which is associated with the illicit passion between Assad and the Queen of Sheba. Again, in the overture, you don't know yet that it means that. But this one gets repeated so often, I think nobody could possibly be in any doubt by the time the opera ends that this means illicit passion. Can we hear it from the overture? It's the next to the last one. We'll learn it. Deutsche Schule. Yeah, all of a sudden it's Liszt or Wagner. And when I heard this, my ears really pricked up, because having studied Stravinsky, I'm very attuned to modulations by minor thirds. That's what we have here, going through a cycle of minor thirds, and the bass is connecting the roots of those chords with passing tones, producing what nowadays we call an octatonic scale, which Rimsky-Korsakov picked up from Liszt, as well as Goldmark. And unlike Goldmark, who just did it by ear, Rimsky-Korsakov really systematized it and turned it into a theory and taught it to Stravinsky, and then Stravinsky became Stravinsky by using that. But that's, of course, another story. That motif, which means passion, is associated with Assad and the Queen. Now, the Queen is the character, strangely enough, who is least set off by Orientalist markers in the opera. And you could easily verify this by listening to the beginning of Act Two, where she has a long solo shena, where she sings about encountering Assad, and although in Act One she has denied knowing him, which is what sets the whole tragic action in motion, she admits when she's alone, just thinking aloud, you know, in a soliloquy, that she also loves him. This whole scene is without any markers at all. And the reason seems to be why she has no markers is that she is unobserved. Nobody is looking at her. And so she is simply being herself and portraying her emotions rather than her external characteristics. But now listen to the place where she is not present on stage, but Assad is telling King Solomon about meeting her. And he first meets her because she's bathing nude in a river, and he just sees her like that, and doesn't know that it's the Queen of Sheba, but of course is very attracted by her beauty. So here we get that passion motif, but we also get, I hope you'll recognize it, another motif that we've already heard. Okay, last. Augmented second, which was associated, which will be associated at the end of Act One with the black slave girls. Because that's all she is to him when he first sees her. You see, the first thing he sees is just a sexy, foreign, perhaps black body. And it's to that that he's reacting, and so that's why that signifier is used. So, two things. First, when she's alone, she has no markers because she doesn't have to be differentiated from anyone else. As soon as somebody's looking at her, she sprouts markers because you're seeing her now through the eyes of other characters, you see. So that is a very subtle touch, it seems to me, on Goldmark's part. And so this shows that this is why I say he's taking stereotypes, but manipulating them in quite original ways. And ways that show, you know, very intelligent application of skill. So he was a master of lots of styles and deployed them with magnificent resourcefulness. And he preferred that versatility to originality. Now I'm saying this obviously with admiration, I hope that's clear. But I'm saying about him exactly what Richard Wagner would say about any Jewish musician, and but saying it to denigrate and to discredit. Of course, if Wagner heard me, he would say, well, what would you expect a Jewish musicologist to be saying? Yes. But what I would say is that this kind of very, very skillful deployment of a very rationalized technique is what all good composers do, manifestly including Wagner. Because if you think about it, Wagner's mature style, the leitmotif style, let's call it, the style that he pioneered with the Reign of the Nibelung, was perhaps the most rationally conceived and willfully applied style in the history of music. We know this because before he wrote the music, he described the style in his writings. So he thought of that first. He thought of what the thing to do is this, and then he decided to do it and did it. So he's doing exactly what he would have Goldmark. He would say Goldmark was doing because of his Jewishness and therefore his inauthenticity as a composer. So I think Goldmark can help us see Wagner the way Wagner saw Mendelssohn and Meyerbeer. So he can help us get over the romantic claptrap that Wagner still makes us believe in. So that's why I have come to value Goldmark so much in the course of doing the research I did for this paper. Thank you very much.